When you think of a thriving business like the online sales division of the excellent restaurant Mama Fuku, or the online sales for Heinz Ketchup, a brand for which my kids will accept no substitute, sure, you might think about a great product and brilliant marketing, but an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers, buying, simple. And millions of businesses are powered by Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify. It's home of the number one checkout experience on the planet, and the not so secret secret, with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform, better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more, sell on Shopify. So upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience that Heinz Ketchup uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/chess, all lowercase letters. That's shopify.com/chess to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/chess.
Today at T-Mobile, I'm joined by a special co-anchor.
What up, everybody? It's your boy, Big Snoop D-O-double-G.
Snoop, where can people go to find great deals?
Head to T-Mobile.com and get 4 iPhone 16s with Apple Intelligence on us, plus 4 lines for $25.
That's quite a deal, Snoop. And when you switch to T-Mobile, you can save versus the other big guys, comparable plans plus streaming.
Respect. When we up out of here.
See how you can save on wireless and streaming versus the other big guys at T-Mobile.com/switch. Apple Intelligence requires iOS 18.1 or later.
This is a message from sponsor Intuit TurboTax. Taxes was getting frustrated by your forms. Now, Taxes is uploading your forms with a snap, and a TurboTax expert will do your taxes for you. One who's backed by the latest tech, which cross-checks millions of data points for absolute accuracy, all of which makes it easy for you to get the most money back guaranteed. Get an expert now at TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. See guaranteed details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a return author joining who I am thrilled to speak with again and will introduce in a minute. I did have one announcement, first of all. So I've been getting emails. You know, my book came out about a year and a half ago at this point, and I know that the audiobook still hasn't been out. It's been frustrating for me. I've been getting emails about it to this day. I really appreciate that some of you have been waiting for the book in audio format, and I have semi-good news. So the good news is the audiobook of Perpetual Chess Improvement is now available everywhere but Amazon/Audible. So that means you can get it on Spotify, Apple, Overdrive. I'll put a link to all the places you can get it as well as in this show note. But I apologize that there's still an issue with the distributor and getting it to Audible. Hopefully that will be resolved soon. But in the meantime, if you're desperate to get the audiobook, you at least can get it some places. Now, as for this week's podcast, so our guest today is one of my favorite authors. He's just written his fourth book. I recommend really reading all of his books in order. I don't think you should skimp when it comes to our author, but we're mainly, of course, going to be discussing his newest book because we have discussed his other work in prior interviews. So his books, first he wrote Move First, Think Later, which those of you interested in chess improvement should definitely read, a revolutionary book. And then he started focusing more on chess history, and this current book is kind of the completion of a trilogy. He's also written On the Origin of Good Moves, which is a classic, The Ink Wars, which we discussed previously, and his new one is called The Philosopher and the Housewife, and it explores the rivalries and disagreements between Tarrasch, Nimzowitsch, and Alepin in early 20th century chess. So with a continued emphasis on common misconceptions about the evolution of chess ideas, which is kind of an overarching theme of our guest writing. So I am super excited to welcome back to the program and to discuss his latest work. I am Willie Hendricks. Welcome, Willie.
Thank you, Ben, for this nice introduction. Nice to be back.
Yeah, great to chat again. That means you've emerged from your cocoon. This book is about 500 pages, so I'm sure it's been keeping you busy, right?
Yeah, it was. I could use some stuff I had done before, but indeed, it's quite something. Yes.
Yeah, quite ambitious, and so much that I learned from it. And for listeners wondering about the general format, so there is chess throughout, but I would say it's like 75% history, 25% chess. Although certainly a few striking positions in there, as we may discuss, and I may even do a bonus video about. But Willie, since I thought the best place to start with this book would be the title, because it is a bit of a provocative title. And I, of course, read the book. But if you've not read the book, you might say, why is a chess book called The Philosopher and the Housewife? So take it away, Willie.
Yeah. Of course, it's a beautiful title. I fought for a chess book. And also for myself, because I studied philosophy, and I'm some sort of a house husband myself, partly. It sounded really like a good idea to combine those two in the title. But it, of course, refers to the subject, Taras and Nemtsovic. To tell a little more about that, as you said, the book is about the rivalry between Taras and Nemtsovic. When Nemtsovic entered the scene, Taras was already the most important chess thinker, chess theoretician. And from that first moment on, Nemtsovic decided to push Taras off his throne. And central in my book is a discussion from 1913 in the Wiener Schachzeitung. And the occasion of that was Taras's second important book, The Modern Game of Chess, Die Moderne Schachpartie. And Nemtsovic's reaction was, well, a nice book by Taras, but it's not modern at all. I'm modern chess.
Right.
And on that occasion, he said about Taras, well, Taras, that's actually not much more than the advice of an experienced housewife. And of course, he meant that negative. I don't take it negative, but of course, Nemtsovic did. And I guess Taras understood it as not as a compliment. So that's the housewife. And Nemtsovic, of course, saw himself as the philosopher, as someone who designed a complete system about, what are the basics in chess theory, the fundamentals of chess theory.
And of course, Nemtsovic studied philosophy at university. So yeah, definitely fits him. And yeah, I do want to echo your point about like this idea of like housewife as a derisive term. You know, we probably wouldn't think of it that way in this era, but back then, it was certainly the intent and certainly how it was taken.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, Nemtsovic is such an interesting personality. You write in the book that you think he is the most self-aggrandizing chess player of all time. Now, there's many legendary stories about his personality, how eccentric he was, you could say. Could you share one or two of your favorites for listeners less familiar with, of course, Nemtsovic being a world-class player, but best known as the author of My System, as we'll discuss later?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of anecdotes, and some are so famous that I decided not to have them in my book, actually. But, well, anecdotes. Well, I would say if you really want to see what kind of person he is, you can also look at his books.
Right, it's
the
there.
Way he annotates games, for example. He's very, in his game annotations, somehow it seems that the opponent doesn't play any role at all. It's all about himself. And that's very typical, I guess, from Nemtsovic. Those anecdotes, well, I think one famous is by Hans Kmoch, who initially went very much along with the idea, with the picture Nemtsovic painted of himself. Later, Kmoch became a bit more, not skeptical, it's not the right word, but a bit more nuanced over Nemtsovic's character. And he also saw that Nemtsovic was really a very defensive person and also a bit paranoia. And so there's this famous anecdote that Nemtsovic, when you went to dine with him, he always thought he got the smaller portion of food. So once Kmoch said, well, you know what we do? We both order what we want, and then we change plates when the food arrives. Okay, says Nemtsovic. And the food arrives, they change plates, and Nemtsovic still thought he had the smaller portion. So Dimsowitz always felt he was a very defensive person. He felt easily attacked, and also, I think Spielman noticed this once that even in very harmless things, he still saw some attack at this person. So he was a really difficult, troubled person, I guess. At the end of the book, I give a quote a lot of people about Nimzowitz, and I invite the reader to make their own assessment of Nimzowitz's personality. I don't want to put him in some sort of category, but it's clear that Nimzowitz was a troubled person with some severe problems.
Yeah, so you don't want to make too much light of it. But the most famous story, of course, which you alluded to and which you uncovered something I didn't know previously in the book, is Nimzowitz, so famously, after he lost a game to Samish, stood on a chair and yelled, "Why must I lose to this idiot?"
Yeah.
But you dug into the provenance of that story. And as you mentioned, Hans Kamak verified it, having heard it firsthand from, as you say, the idiot himself from Samish. So...
Yeah, okay, that's very famous, but probably that was not a serious tournament. That's not some kind of blitz tournament. So I guess Nimzowitz was a bit joking there, and it fits in the atmosphere of coffee house chess.
That's true. But you also tell a story of him challenging someone to a fist fight. There being discussion of a duel and a fist fight after he lost a game.
Yeah, that's in a book by Edward Lasker, who was. A very distant relative of world champion Emmanuel Lasker. Edward Lasker gave that anecdote, and he was present, but still it's not clear how much, if it really happened that way. But it also sheds some light on Nimzowitz's character, because in that tournament, Hamburg 1910, he played against a certain person who had insulted him a few years before, and he had insulted him with his annotations of a game of Nimzowitz. So he was too critical of Nimzowitz, or he used the wrong words. Anyway, years later, Nimzowitz was still very angry about those comments. So in that game, he behaved really strange. So he arrived too late, then went to watch all the paintings on the wall, walked around, only then came to the board, did a lot of other things before he made his first move, standing rather nonchalant, and so on and on. So his opponent felt very insulted by Nimzowitz's behavior, and he maybe challenged him to a duel with the pistol. And then Nimzowitz, so next day after the round, the seconds of this insulted player arrived at Nimzowitz's house, and they said, "Well, Mr., he wants to have a duel with you on the pistol." And Nimzowitz said something like, "Well, we'll be better fight it out with bare fists." But it's completely unclear what is true of this, of course.
Okay, it's good. I mean, it's admirable.
But what is true is, of course, that it's typical of Nimzowitz that he was so insulted by comments from years ago. That said something about his playing style
So
he was easily insulted.
And quick to strike back, whether verbally or
because
in this case.
He himself was also very capable of
insulting.
Yes.
And to set the stage for listeners, I suppose we should also discuss sort of the chess fundamental disagreements. Now, you being such a student of history, having played through thousands of games in sequential order, as we've discussed in prior interviews and as you've written, you think that these stylistic differences are overrated. And I'd like to discuss that more in due time. But first, what were the perceived differences, as you say, already a top player, one of the most prolific and successful writers, when Nimzowitz comes up on the scene, and then Nimzowitz comes along and says, no, he's wrong about this, he's wrong about that, you know, it's the advice of a housewife, et cetera, et cetera. By the way, there's a listener who keeps correcting me in the comments that I say et cetera instead of et cetera. So listen, I think it's Mr. Snrub. I'm going to try. It's been 40 years I've been saying it wrong. But I'm hereby making an effort to say it correctly. So shout out to a listener in the comments. I do read the comments, but anyway, back to the chess. So could you discuss the stylistic or philosophical disagreements of Nimzowitz and Tarrasch?
Yeah, they also had something in common, and we'll discuss that later again when Alapin enters the scene.
Yeah.
But what they had in common, they were both in search of the higher principles. And they also had this idea that chess has some higher principles, and they both were looking for those, well, this eternal truth of chess. And so that's what they had in common. Taras is often depicted as a better Steinitz, someone who took Steinitz and removed all the strange things in Steinitz. There are a lot of strange things in Steinitz, of course. He removed them and made a much more sensible Steinitz, whereas Nemtsovich, who also was a fan of Steinitz, he was much more, he liked those peculiarities of Steinitz. So Taras is mostly seen as a very classical player, so famous for all those classical principles like speedy development in the opening, take care of the center, all those sorts of things. All these things we understand as classical chess, that's Taras. Also a fan of the classical openings. And Nemtsovich was the opposite, and his main point, and that was a very good point, Taras said he should always do something in the center. In the beginning of the game, you have to fight for the center with your pawns. And Nemtsovich said, no, you can also play for the center with pieces. You don't have to directly say play e4, e5 or play d4, d5. And his main opening, of course, Nemtsovichian starts with, with not directly taking possession of the center, but first developing your pieces. So d4, knight f6, c4, e6. Knight c3, bishop b4. So that was a very valid point from Nemtsovich, but that was one of the differences. But in general, also speed. Taras was something who liked speedy development. One of his most famous sayings is, das Tempo ist die Seele des Schachspiels. Speed is the soul of chess. And if you look at Nemtsovich, from the beginning, he was always looking for those systems that do not have speedy development. Like he likes, for example, those Philidor setups with, e4, e5, knight f3, d6, and then play knight b, d7 before you have developed your bishop on c8. So all those, well, this was very unclassical. That gave a big clash, for example. There are other things, but that's already an important example. Also, to have more space was an important point for Taras. One of his other famous saying is, cramped game already harbors the seeds of law. And that was something that Nemtsovich liked, just like Taras. He liked those cramped positions with hope of play later on in the game. These are a few differences.
Yeah. And as you allude to, the way Nemtsovich played, there certainly is a grain of truth to it. Even if you look at the openings that are named after Nemtsovich, like the Nemtsovich Sicilian, where you're going knight f6 on the second move. And of course, most famously, the Nemtso-Indian, which obviously has stood the test of time. And Black does take a stake in the center with one of his pawns, typically, but not on the first move. You know, on the first move, you're bringing your knight out and then moving your pawn one square. So you're not just immediately, like they plant your flag, you plant yours the way you would in king pawn or double queen pawn, which is kind of where Taras was coming from. But despite the fact that there's a grain of truth, especially when it comes to the opening, you make the broader point in the book that Nemtsovich cherry-picked his examples in the stuff that he wrote and liked to present that he was the originator of many ideas that he laid out in his classical works. But the truth was a bit more complicated, right, Willie?
Yeah, well, that's difficult. If you look at the same time, Richard Reti wrote his famous book, and he Modern Ideas in Chess, and he has this historical perspective in his books. He looks at all those different players that from history, and looks how things developed. But if you look at Nemtsovich's main work, the first main, he had two important works, My System, that lacks this historical perspective. So when you read Nemtsovich, you get this impression that everything is Nemtsovich. Everything in this book is Nemtsovich's own ideas. And he often presents things like his own ideas that weren't really, well, others had thought of that too. And for example, Bent Larsen also noticed this, that so much of Nemtsovich was already known before him. For example, the famous Nemtsovich has a big chapter on seventh rank. And Larsen says, of course, well, seventh rank was that was known before Nimzowitsch. It's, of course, that's such a basic thing in chess, the value of the seventh rank, that
This is for rooks in endgames, just to be clear.
At the time of Greco, they already knew this. And also, Nimzowitsch liked to talk of about my theory of the open file. But of course, the open file, well, throughout the complete history of chess, the open file is such a basic thing. Others have thought about that before Nimzowitsch. But if you read Nimzowitsch, it's very difficult to distinguish between what is really his own findings and what is already. That's also because Nimzowitsch, in my system, he gives almost exclusively his own games.
Right.
So in the introduction, he says, well, I will be criticized because I give only my own games, but, well, it's my system. Why can't I illustrate it with my own games? But, for example, in those times, Capablanca was the world champion. If you write a manual on positional chess, you might think, well, maybe Capablanca has also some good games on positional chess. But that was something that didn't occur to Nimzowitsch. That's also...
Yeah, and you provide some insightful, concrete examples in the book of like, he, you know, he said he invented this, but here's an example where it happened, you know, 15 years prior. Yeah. And it fits into what you lay out, his overall personality type of this sort of constant braggadocious and combative writing style. And we have a question from a listener, Willie, related to Nimzowitsch. The question is from Dave Sim. Dave, thanks for helping to support Perpetual Chess. It is much appreciated. And Dave asks, he says, plenty of people still seem to recommend my system over everything written since as a first proper strategy book. Is there any justification for this in terms of its instructive value? And if not, why do they keep doing it? Now, you discussed this in the book, but you can give a shorter answer here.
Yeah, well, I think you yourself have discussed this topic. For example, in an earlier podcast with Christoph Silecki, you discussed my system. I think that was a very nice edition of your podcast. And you both, I think, more or less agreed, well, it's not absolutely necessary to read my system if you want to become a stronger player. But it's a bit tricky, I think, for me to... Because regarding Nimzowitsch, you have this divide between you either love him or you hate him. And for me, as an objective historian, I'll have to be somehow neutral. But that's very difficult regarding Nimzowitsch. It's really difficult to somehow stay objective because you either feel very much attracted or maybe more a bit, not so enthusiastic. So... I think it's something from the past, this recommendation which keeps turning up. But no, I don't. I agree with you and Christoph Silecki. And no, if you want to become a stronger chess player, my system is not the first book to go to. But from a historical perspective, it's of course a very interesting and important book. And I hope in the way I present it in the discussion with Tarash, it is interesting. Also in the regarding chess improvement, but maybe a bit more on a meta level in a discussion about how did chess theory develop. This recommendation is forever, and I'm not sure all those people who recommend it have actually read my system. So you never know. That you can say what you want about this book, but that this recommendation will never go away.
Yeah,
but especially of the book. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, and one point you raised that I can't remember if Christoph and I actually, if either of us mentioned this, but I think it bears highlighting is one thing to keep in mind is the book is called My System, but it's not really a system. As you point out, it's just kind of a random scattershot collection of chapters.
Yeah, I had to be a bit careful, but clearly Nimzowitsch is not a systematic thinker.
Right.
Not at all. I would say. And others before me, for example, Raymond Keene, who wrote a famous book on Nimzowitsch, he was a fan, but he still wrote a very nuanced book on Nimzowitsch, A Reappraisal. And he noticed this also. He says, well, maybe not see it as a complete system, but as a collection of a few brilliant insights.
Right.
And I think that's the best way to approach Nimzowitsch. There are a few very interesting things, but it's not a system. And I think that's the right way to look at it.
Yeah. And for listeners, I did want to mention that subsequent to the review podcast that Willie alluded to with Christoph Zalecki discussing the kind of classic editions of My Systems, about in June of last year, I did one with Alex Fishbein, who did a fast track edition updating My System and condensing it, which is important. And as I said then, I just want to echo, Alex did a great job with that. And if you do want to kind of get the greatest hits without all of the fat and the squabbling and the weird linguistic ticks, then Alex's book is a great way to go. But I would still stand by Willie's broader point that it's, you know, it was really insightful for its time. And there weren't a lot of chess books then, so it got recommended. But I'm not sure if any chess book is necessary to become a grandmaster these days. So no, let alone My System.
No, but I haven't read Alex Fishbein's book. I saw your podcast and I read the introduction, and probably it's a beautiful book. But if you remove all the weird, strange things from Nimzowitsch, well, it's not Nimzowitsch anymore.
That's a good
point.
That's
my small concern. You talked about this with Christoph Zalecki, and you said, well, all those discussions with Taras in that book, they seem to have no big, they can be left out. But right. I hope that in my book, if you put it in perspective, you really need Taras to understand Nimzowitsch and also understand some strange things about Nimzowitsch, because he's in constant discussion with Taras. Right. Taras is the guy that came before him, and he's very often, well, he's in discussion with Taras. And if you take those two together, you get, I think, a beautiful story. But if you read My System standalone, then this doesn't work out. Then you think, what is this guy? What has he to do with Taras? And so I think in combination, Taras is a very important part of Nimzowitsch.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more from author and international master Willie Hendricks.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. When your computer breaks, you don't wait for it to magically start working again. You fix the problem. So why wait to hire the people your company desperately needs? Use Indeed Sponsored Jobs to hire top talent fast. And even better, you only pay for results. There's no need to wait. Speed up your hiring with a $75 sponsored job credit at Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
My watch says we've gone 3 miles. This app is like having a personal trainer.
Yeah, but those apps collect a lot of your personal data. Aren't you worried?
Really? That's creepy. How do I stop that?
You should go to privacy.ca.gov to learn about your privacy rights and get on the best path to protect your privacy.
You think they could help us get up this next hill?
One step at a time.
Californians have the strongest privacy protections in the country. Go the extra mile to protect your information. Learn more at privacy.ca.gov.
This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. It's tax season, and we're all a bit tired of numbers. But here's one you need to hear. $16.5 billion. That's how much the IRS flagged for possible identity fraud last year. Now here's a good number. 100 million. That's how many data points LifeLock monitors every second. If your identity is stolen, they'll fix it, guaranteed. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
And then, as you briefly touched on earlier, there's a third kind of main character, not quite as main in the book, but plays an important role, who is Semyon Alepin. Where does Alepin fit into this period of chess?
Yeah, he has a very special role. We already had the philosopher and the housewife. And in this discussion in 1913, in the Wiener Schachzeitung, Nimzowitsch launched his big attack on Taras. And then Alepin reacted. Alepin was a decent player, not as strong as Nimzowitsch and Taras, but and a prolific author. He wrote a lot on opening theory. And Alepin's main point was that in this discussion between Taras and Nimzowitsch, they were both very much concentrating on the general theory. And he said they had too little attention for the concrete variations. I think he formulated that very beautifully. He said, for example, about Taras. Well, Taras beautifully speaks about all those games and positions, but the reader of those books of Taras, he thinks he understands the subjects. He thinks he has understood the chess, but what he has only learned to talk chess. He hasn't learned chess, but he has learned to talk chess. Alpins as well. All those words, you easily get carried away by all those words and all those general concepts. But it's much more important to concentrate on the concrete moves, on the variations. Those general theories are only very modest signposts, but the road to go is the road of the concrete variations. And that's, of course, a very modern standpoint. And Nimzowitz reacted on that, and he said, well, my philosophy, you can't attack my philosophy with only variations. My philosophy can only be attacked with philosophical arguments. And he said, Tarrasch, advice of a housewife. And so he said, Alpin, that's a variantenkünstler, an artist of variations. So actually, that should have been in the title as well. But then the title would become too long, the philosopher, the housewife, and the variantenkünstler.
Yeah.
But Alpin is a very modern point of view. And I think talking about chess improvement, that still holds today, that analysis of Alpin, that if people in the, say, in the improvement market, in videos and in books, they can tell beautifully about positions and maybe they give it a bit extra. But the readers or the watchers or listeners, they get the impression, well, now this sounds really good. Now I understand everything. But
Right. Actually,
they mainly have learned to talk chess, how to talk chess, not how to play chess. And that's, if you take those three positions, at the end of my book, I somehow try to have a look at those three positions and determine my own position. Well, those who know me will probably guess in what direction my conclusions will go. But those are actually three positions in my book. And others engage in the discussion, like the hypermoderns, Richard Reti, Savielli Tartakower, and also the world champions of the period, like Lasker, Capablanca, and Alekhine.
So to be clear, the three positions are...
Yeah, well, what are they? The Nimzowitz view of Tarrasch, which is the housewife, which is someone with practical advice. For every position, Tarrasch has some practical to say, and I elaborate on that with the well-known theme of the rules and exceptions. Tarrasch was someone who had clear rules. Well, this type of very beautiful rule, for example, I think is the Harakiri move. Tarrasch, in some game, his opponent played g7, g5, he had castled kingside. And Tarrasch said, well, if you have castled kingside and the move g7, g5 doesn't immediately gain something very special, then I call it the Harakiri move. You completely destroy your own king safety. And so that's a very powerful rule. Of course, in that book, a few games later, Tarrasch plays g4 himself, and suddenly no mentioning of the Harakiri rule anymore. But that's you can say that's Tarrasch. That's the maxims, all those sensible advice. And then we have Nimzowitz, which is much more philosophical, a system with also Tarrasch likes to speak of this law or that law and dogma of this, and supposedly that's a complete system with where everything is connected, and also with some very deep concepts. Well, you know, the most difficult concepts in chess language, they stem from Nimzowitz, like prophylaxis and überdeckung, protection. So that's the philosopher, a complete comprehensive system with the promise of very deep strategy. And then we have Alpin, who says, well, all those general considerations, they are overrated. They give some direction. They might be useful signposts, but much more important are those concrete analyses and variations. And that goes in the modern direction of what John Watson famously called rule independence.
Yeah.
The rules and the general principles become less important. And the concrete chess is much more leading in how the modern player looks at the game.
Yeah, that of course laid out in Secrets of Modern Chess Strategy. And I like the quote that you give, it's the moves that matter, which to what Willy hinted at earlier, certainly the overarching point, you need only look at the title of Willy's first book to know where he stands.
Actually, Watson said the move is the idea.
The move is the idea, sorry.
In your own book, where you talked about in the beginning. I enjoyed it very much. But there you quote someone who said the moves, it's the moves that matter, I guess.
Right, Rousen, I think, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, also, that's the name of Rousen's book.
He had
the
title for his book, but I don't know if he agrees, but you quote someone else in your own book when you discussed the value of classic chess, and you said, well, okay, then the moves that matter, yeah. The move is the idea. That's the...
Yeah, and then...
And somehow, and that's the credit I give to Alepin, I think he was the first person in chess history who more or less eloquently formulated this position. That's how I bring in Alepin in my...
I think it might have been Narayanyan. Now I'm struggling to remember who I quoted in my own book. It's been a while.
But, might be.
But that gets to a broader point you make at the end that I also felt like, oh, I should have thought of that myself. So in discussing the evolution of chess and your sort of overarching theme, again, across your writing, that people want chess, like you argue it, it's been evolutionary progress, not revolutionary. There's not like massive leaps forward in ideas. I mean, it's a complex system. And you make some, and across your writing, make comparisons to Darwinian evolution, where things just progress slowly and, you know, are all mixed together. And there's not these like linear improvements. But in talking about how we become better at chess, you look at the example, you cite the example of engines in the modern era as kind of proof that we don't become better by verbalizing ideas, or at least one can become great without verbalizing ideas, because in AlphaZero, of course, most famously, but just engines generally are all moves.
Yeah. Well, maybe if you make a combination of a sort of ChatGPT thing like, and AlphaZero, they probably can also talk about his own chess. But if you look at the way AlphaZero has handled it, that is somehow similar to what I think is actually happened in chess history as well. Chess history is often, for example, by Richard Rathe, is presented as a top-down history with the great players with revolutionary ideas shaping the way history developed. Well, I like to look from a more bottom-up perspective, and I think that the way, development of opening theory is really the motor behind chess improvement throughout the times, and that's much more bottom-up with all those players in competition with each other looking for small improvements. Also, if you look at the chess literature, it has always concentrated on the openings, and it's not so much the big ideas, but the small improvements in the openings. And also, and someone, for example, gets a very a new idea, like take Elkin's defense. E4 knight, was that a big idea? I guess someone looked at this move. Well, maybe probably not possible, E4 knight of 6, but well, have a look. And maybe not, you cannot immediately, it doesn't seem to be, maybe it's possible. And you try a bit more and you introduce it in competition, in serious competition. Opponents are going to look for ways to fight it. And along the way, all type of new positions, type of positions arise that haven't been seen before. So that's actually the way our chess knowledge develops. In the openings and throughout this competition, especially on the level of openings, all those new strategies and tactics slowly come to the fore. So that's a much more bottom-up perspective of how chess develops.
Yeah, and on that theme, you write about what you call the trainer's fallacy. What's the trainer's fallacy?
Well, that's maybe a bit ambitious formulation for me, but I hesitated a bit about putting that in. But what I want to say is, when it comes to talking about chess, the trainer's fallacy is not so much that he thinks that he has this enormous power of explaining, but it's much more underestimating his own, the enormous amount of knowledge he brings to the board. So when he talks about positions that he doesn't see, and I use the example of the French defense, the famous bad bishop, the French bishop, for example, the bishop on d7, that when strong player, he knows so much about that bishop and all the things that bishop can do, that he doesn't realize when someone who is much less skilled, maybe a beginner or a bit above, he doesn't see the same bishop. And the idea that you can talk about, that you all this knowledge you have, even about that bishop alone, that you can somehow transfer all this finely differentiated knowledge you have to someone who hasn't that knowledge. That's what I call the trainer's fallacy. Maybe a bit pretentious, but... And especially Tarash has this, but Tarash, his last famous book titled Das Schachspiel, The Game of Chess, in it he says, well, the novice should first completely read this book, finish the book completely, do not start playing before you completely finish this book. And then, if you do this, you already probably as good as most of the club players are. Mm-hmm. So you only read the book and you haven't played any game, and then you could enter the arena and already compete with club players. That's a typical overestimation of the general principles. And I think Tarash clearly shows this idea well. I can explain it. I can explain it so well that even someone who hasn't touched the pieces before can read my book and then play a decent game. That's the kind of, you can call it overestimation of your own explaining skills, but I guess it's much more underestimation of how finely differentiated your own knowledge is, how much knowledge you have gathered throughout your complete chess life.
That was impressive. I had a note, you know, like when I read books for interviews, I often read on the New in Chess Reader, as I did for this one. And like for points that really resonate, I'll keep in an outline. Since you can't highlight, at least that I'm aware of on the New in Chess Reader, I'll take a screenshot and then like kind of compile them. But you almost managed to word for word repeat what you wrote in the book, which is impressive, because the line about their knowledge being very finely differentiated really resonated with me, and I was reviewing it before the interview. Yeah, and it also gets to what you were saying about the ability to think concretely. You know, a trainer might be quick to tell a student, like, oh, in these positions, you do this, this, and this. And similar to the example you cited of Tarash moving the g-pawn in front of the castled king. But it's the exceptions that's where the money is figuring out when something is an exception and when something isn't.
Yeah, well... there's also always this big theme of the general and the concrete. That's a big theme in my books. And I don't deny the idea of some basic general principles. But I think with Tarash and also Nimzowitsch, you have the idea that you have these general principles and the general understanding, and the concrete moves will flow out of it. Tarash, for example, speaks about the spirit of the opening. He says you have to understand it. Do not memorize moves. First, you have to understand the spirit of the opening. Well, I don't know what that is, but and then on the basis of that, you should play the opening. But you can also turn things around and learn moves, start practicing, and maybe the general understanding. It's not at the beginning of the process, it's at the end. It's what you said, the finely differentiated, yeah. The feel for the opening. It's not something, that spirit of the opening, that's something that that you get rewarded with at the end. And that's when talking about variations, sometimes chess trainers or writers say you have to understand the variation. But my question is, what does it mean to understand the variation? But my answer is more variations. If you understand the variation, that shows itself in the ease with which you can add more variations. Like, for example, when you're teaching someone, he says, well, can I castle queenside here? You say, well, here it's not so good, but if this and this, it might be an ID. Or in all kind of positions that you can say, well, here this is an ID. Sometimes it's an ID, but here it's not so good because of this and this. But if these moves are placed, then maybe it's an interesting ID. So this knowledge the understanding is at the end. When you have a lot of practice and a lot of study, then you feel the finer points. So that's something kind of turn around. So those people who say, well, you have to understand the variation, maybe you should just learn a variation and start playing and then look back at what you've done.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. First of all, I just want to mention what you're saying is certainly echoing what like recent guest Nate Solon mentioned as well. And I generally agree with your point, but I think that when what people are getting at is if you think of like a Nimzowitsch like mysterious rook move, like you're going like, you know, you're moving your rook to a closed file and you don't understand why. Someone, and then a trainer tells you, well, it's because if they open the file with this exchange, then your rook is well placed. Well, mm-hmm. they've given you moves that help you understand the idea. But I do think that you're more likely to remember the move if they have told you that than if they haven't, you know?
Yeah, you say the truth is in the middle. It's always a chicken and egg
right.
problem. That's true. That's true. Yes.
Yeah.
So, what I do in the end is my favorite comparison of what a chess trainer can do. I like to compare it with a chef de cuisine, a master cook. And the way she teaches pupils to become good cooks. And that is by simply showing recipes, cooking together, telling how it's done. And so a good chess coach is someone who has a lot of recipes, enormous right. amount of recipes, just like a good cook. And first the pupil starts, simply following up on the recipe. And if you have absorbed enough recipes, there comes the moment that you feel you get some general understanding and you feel maybe I can experiment myself. So I can, I have a recipe with carrots. Maybe I can use aubergine as well. not very likely, but something like that. Or this idea of understanding, greater understanding that comes at the end after. So, and of course, a chess trainer can, of course, he should talk when he's explaining things or telling about things. But I like the idea of that he's mainly someone who has such enormous amount of recipes and looking at the position, he sees what recipes apply, what maybe apply, or in somehow similar situations. That's an idea I like very much, a comparison I like very much.
Yeah, I like that analogy. That's good.
We'll be right back with more from author and international master Willie Hendricks.
The second half of the basketball season is here, and the race to the playoffs continues on Prize Picks, the best daily fantasy sports app to cash in on your favorite sports. The app is simple. Pick more or less on at least two players for a shot to win up to 1,000 times your cash. Download the Prize Picks app today and use code FIELD and get $50 instantly when you play $5. That's code FIELD on Prize Picks to get $50 instantly when you play $5. Win or lose, you'll get $50 for just playing. Guaranteed. Prize Picks. Run your game. Must be present in certain states. Visit prizepicks.com for restrictions and details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
With the Blue Cash Everyday Card, it's easy to earn 3% cash back on groceries at U.S. supermarkets, U.S. online retail purchases, and U.S. gas stations. That's how we grow our family's little nest egg. Learn more at americanexpress.com/explore-bc. Terms and cash back cap apply.
Well, Willie, we've got one more listener question. This one is from Brian Karen, who is an avid chess reader and a fan of your work. Then thanks for helping to support Perpetual Chess, Brian. And he says, I've really enjoyed your books, especially the last two, which explored the rivalries between Zukertort and Steinitz. He's alluding to Ink Wars in that one, as well as Nimzowitsch, Tarrasch, and Alepin. Do you plan to continue this theme in future works? And what ideas, if any, do you have for upcoming books?
Well, regarding chess history, I'm not so sure. I think this is one, Tarrasch Nimzowitsch is one of the greatest rivalries, and may not exactly the last, but regarding this central theme of chess philosophy, chess theory, it was a very big fight. I don't have concrete plans for another historical work going further in the future. And of course, chess life is expanding expansionally. For example, the world of Steinitz and Zukertort, that's not that big. Nimzowitsch, Tarrasch, and the whole world around it is already much, much bigger. And I somehow have a grasp on that, but it becomes it becomes bigger and also stronger.
Right.
The players throughout history, they become ever more stronger. I feel somehow, I can write about Steinitz and Zukertort for sure. I have the feeling, they're more somehow in my league, Tarash, Nimzowitz, and especially people like Capablanca and Lasker, then okay, they're all becoming a bit stronger. Players are becoming ever more stronger, and I'm not sure I'm the right person to write about that. So that's a bit a modest standpoint.
That's interesting.
So maybe I'll pick some historical theme, but I haven't got any concrete plans on chess history at the moment.
I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because I feel like your books, I mean, obviously there's plenty, as I mentioned, there's plenty of chess in it, and it's, you know, it is central to what you write, but you're not doing like move by move analysis of like, you know, this is what Capablanca was thinking here or something. So I would think you could still move forward, but also to your point about sort of the evolution of chess ideas, there does become a point as the number of players grows and the strength of the players grows, where you just can't pinpoint things. You know, you just can't say, oh, here's the one tactical player, you know, here's the one who believed in this, because everyone's doing everything at once.
Yeah. And there are, of course, already very good books on later chess history. I think, for example, Kasparov in his famous series concentrates on later chess history. And I think Mikhail Marin has a new book out, and he has a famous first book also on this topic. So it's not, I feel those books I've written now have really add something to what already was there.
I strongly agree. Yeah, strongly recommend listeners check out Willie's entire catalog. And Willie, so obviously, again, 500-page book, you wrote it in a couple years, which is really impressive. Are you keeping up with modern chess? Like, do you follow the chess and the drama both?
A little bit. Well, there's a lot of drama. What I find interesting, of course, in chess history is those people who still were able to discuss about these topics. And I mentioned that at the end of my book, it's a bit a melancholic undertone, because with the rise of the engine, we cannot have any discussions anymore about what is the best move, or what's the value of an opening, or these things. So there's a lot of discussion in the chess world right now, but more about the cheating and freestyle chess, and also interesting. But I think it's a little bit lost that we cannot have those discussions anymore, which Tarash and Nimzowitz could have together. So, but I follow chess still.
Yeah, I mean, even at my amateur level, like, you know, we would spend hours arguing about some position just randomly, you know, that would never happen now, you know, like, who's better in this position, you know?
That's a bit sad, of course.
Well, it's definitely.
But it's still interesting. And also other things have come in place, like the way chess is connected with development of artificial intelligence. Chess. What I still interests me very much is, the question what tells chess about the way our brain functions in combination with artificial intelligence, the way the computer has handled chess, and all those developments. With chess, we have always been on the first row regarding the development of artificial intelligence. And those are also very interesting subjects. So we have lost some things, but we were still playing an interesting game with a lot of connections to interesting subjects.
For sure. And Willie, when you're researching a book, do you have time to do reading outside of chess? Are you doing casual reading as well?
Yeah, I read a lot outside chess. Well, of course, in my book, at the end of my book, the American philosopher Daniel Dennett plays a big role. He has recently, he died last year, I think. I like his work very much, and I try to at the end of my book, I try to see how he fits in my view. Subtitle of his, one of his books is The Evolution of Minds, and I try to look at how his ideas are they also valid for the evolution of chess minds. That's my so all these I read a lot of science and evolutionary science and
It comes across in your chess writing
and about psychology, cognitive psychology, and all these. So maybe I'm going to do a bit regarding the question about what I'm planning next. Maybe I'm finally going to write something in the line of my first book, returning to my initial subject of Yeah, well, what I just told, how does chess, what does it tell us about the functioning of our own brain? I think chess is a very nice entrance to that question. And also a question you are interested in about the aging brain.
Yeah.
Adult improvement. I'm at an age that there are really quite some worries at this point. Getting near to 60, that's usually not a very good sign for the chess player. So, but even then, it remains very interesting to see how chess can be helpful to see what happens in your brain. So that might be a topic I'm going to explore.
Sounds fantastic. And what about chess books? Do you have any recommendations from the past few years? Are you managing to read any of the new books?
I anticipated that question, but not that last part of the last few years.
Well, you can, okay, we'll
I
let it slide.
I wanted to recommend Tarash 300 Schachpartien, Tarash 300 Games of Chess, one of them. That's an earlier reader question was about Nimzowitsch My System, which gets recommended all the time. You don't hear that much about Tarash 300 Schachpartien, 300 Games of Chess, but that's also a classic that deserves to be read still. It's a very entertaining book. Tarash was a good writer. I would say he was the better writer of the two.
It's still
quite readable.
Okay.
And I talked about, you mentioned that anecdote about Nimzowitsch and the duel, the challenge. It was written down by Edward Lasker, the distant relative of Emmanuel Lasker. And yes, and he lived for a big part of his life. He lived in the United States and wrote several books that I think maybe still can be found. For example, Chess Secrets I Learned from the Masters. And I like that type of book. He played at a decent level. He even participated in the famous New York 1924 tournament. So he was a decent player. And he has all those inside stories. That's what I like very much, the people who were participating and witness and gives us insight views on all those famous players.
Yeah.
And I would like to mention also, I think that's not translated in English, Milan Widmar, A Golden Schachzeit, and I have a few fragments of his books in this last book. Also beautiful stories, and he was one of the top players at the time of Nimzowitsch and Tarash. But when it comes down to recent books, a book more or less in the same genre is the collected stories of Genna Sosonko.
Yeah.
That is collected in the Essential Sosonko, I think.
Yeah.
And he's also someone who has been part of that world and also talked to a lot of people who even were part of the chess world before. So especially, of course, Soviet chess is, well, I think he saved a lot of all those interesting stories about the Soviet chess that otherwise might have been lost. So if it comes to recent books on chess history, I would like to.
Did you read your Dutch compatriot Paul van der Sterns? I mean, it was out in Dutch 10 years ago, so you may have read it a while ago.
Oh yeah, I've read that book also. Very, very personal story.
Yeah. Yeah, this is Chess in Black and White. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great book. And are you playing it all, Willie?
And now and then.
Okay.
Maybe if I'm indeed going to write about the aging chess brain, I'll have to...
Playing makes a big difference. Yeah, it really brings home all of our faults, all of our frailties.
So I'll have to play myself a bit more.
Yeah, okay. Excellent. Are you playing okay?
Sometimes.
That's all we can ask for.
You have to play a lot of games to get a reasonable picture. And that's if you only play, say, 10 games a year, you do not really get a good picture of is it in what direction
right.
you are moving. So you need big numbers for that, more games.
Yeah, for sure. Well, the book is called The Philosopher and the Housewife. As we're recording this on March 5th, it's available from New in Chess. Probably you can get a physical copy in Europe. You can definitely get the ebook where you like download an app from New in Chess, the New in Chess electronic reader. And I personally, having read it, would recommend it that way. There is enough chess in there where it's better to be able to play through the moves, but I wouldn't say it's indispensable. I would, if you want to have a physical book and read it in bed, I think it's a reasonable choice for that too. And as I mentioned, if you're not familiar, listeners, with Willie's prior works, I recommend all of them. The first one that he mentioned, a possible follow-up to Move First, Think Later, is much more chess improvement focused for those of you interested in that. And then if you want to hear these crazy stories and learn about all these misconceptions about chess history, then you can dive into the trilogy that Willie has just completed. Congratulations, Willie. I know it's been a lot of work.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, great to chat. And whatever you decide to do next, I'll be excited to discuss it with you when it's ready.
I'll gladly come back to your show.
Excellent. Take care, Willie.
Yes, thank you.
Bye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.